Hello, everybody. Welcome in to the Lakers Collective. We've got a lot to get into on today's show, reacting to Game 1, Lakers Thunder Western Conference Semifinal Series. Talk a bit about the game overall. We'll talk about the Lakers offense. We'll talk about ice cold Reeves Austin. Austin 316. Yikes. We'll talk about that performance. Take some questions and comments from the chat as well. Jovan Buha, Jason Timpf, I'm Trevor Lane. Guys, I guess before we even get into anything, Jovan, we just got an update moments before we came on air here about Luka. Let's start there. Why don't you fill us in on that, and then we'll kind of go from there.
Yeah, so we just heard from Luka for the first time since the injury. We also got a timetable on Luka for the first time. There had been one out, I believe, from ESPN that was originally 4 to 6 weeks. But Luka said his actual initial timetable was 8 weeks, and that he was initially told 8 weeks, and it has continued to be 8 weeks. He is trying to come back as soon as he can. He also let us know that he was in Spain to get PRP treatment, and that they have some of the best PRP treatment in the world, and that he was out there so long because he had 4 rounds of PRP treatment. And I guess the way that the treatment works is you have to have a 4-day break in between each round of treatment. So he was out there for 16 days with 4-day breaks in between each of the rounds of treatment. So that's the latest update. That does not seem to indicate optimism in terms of Luka returning. He just passed the 5-week mark with the injury. So 3 more weeks would put the Lakers at like the back end of the Western Conference Finals if they are able to advance and make it that far. So it seems like it either seems like Luka's going to drastically beat that timetable and come back at least a couple weeks early on the most optimistic side, or more realistically, it's going to be the 8 weeks. And at that point, Lakers are either in the late Western Conference Finals or the season is over.
Right. So this is a pretty good, again, not definitive, not set in stone, but pretty good indication that we're not going to see Luka this series. And, you know, for all the people out there, but Anthony Edwards returned in X amount. This is a totally different injury, totally different person. But it's something that you've got to be very, very careful with in this situation. I mean, Jason, we've talked about this. You can't rush Luka back in this situation. Otherwise, you could wind up creating a much bigger problem.
Yeah, again, I wouldn't say it's off the table in the sense that, like, I think if the Lakers manage to steal one in the next couple of games, I think that it becomes a little bit more of a complicated decision, in the sense that, like, if they had a game 4 that is literally a week from the Monday that we just passed, and he's already running, like, if he's already running, then in theory he's going to be kind of ramping up with some more movement in the next couple of days. And there's a universe where, like, by Friday he's doing one-on-one, and by, you know, Saturday he's doing 3-on-3, and then maybe he just feels good, and, like, it's a, you know, 2-1 series looking at the game 4 on Monday, and he decides to come back. Like, I wouldn't put it out of the realm of possibility. But again, like, I think as we discussed in our last show, this season undoubtedly was a huge step forward for the organization. One of the most likable Laker teams that we can remember in years past in terms of the culture, and just how, I mean, it was frustrating for a good chunk of the year, so I shouldn't over-index on that direction. But
just block like, December through February, yes, from your mind.
then it was fun, yes.
But in retrospect, like, you know, especially given the injuries to Luka and Austin that took place during that run, the stretch in March was a really encouraging, like, foundation for the team moving forward. We got a lot of valuable data about different types of players on the roster. Like, if Ayton was the starting center next year, I wouldn't have a huge problem with that. That was something that I think a couple months ago we would have all been, like, severely disappointed if Ayton was the starting center. And, like, LeBron obviously looks like a key part of this team in the next, like, 1 to 2 years as, like, part of their title run. Like,
sure,
Luka Doncic showed his MVP upside. Like, it's very clear the kinds of players that they need to surround him with in order to make this work. So, like, going back to what we talked about before the Houston series, the most important thing for Luka is for him to be 100% in October. So, like, I actually, at that point in time, if you guys remember, I was of the opinion he should not even consider coming back. Mm-hmm. And LeBron getting them out of the first round and the Lakers stealing one of the next couple of games, I think would at least make it interesting enough to where, like, if I found out, like, we got the Shams tweet that was like, Luke is playing game four, I'd be like, okay, I get it. Like, they're looking at Minnesota and San Antonio as vulnerable, and the Eastern Conference has a bunch of teams that are beatable. If Luka comes back and they can steal the series against OKC, they suddenly become like maybe the championship favorite, or at least in the conversation, right? So, like, it would at least be like defensible to play Luka if you're down 2-1 in the series. But I also think it would be fully defensible if, like, Luka was playing 1-on-1 or 3-on-3 this weekend and looking pretty good, and they were like, let's just not risk it. I think that would be completely defensible as well, because ultimately they probably won't beat OKC. And the next season is like this real opportunity for them to make a run with the right tweaks. So it's just important with these hamstring injuries, especially, just to look at the long view.
100%. 100%, and how these next few games go, it could very well be a factor in this decision. But Luka's saying the initial timetable was 8 weeks. That doesn't give me a lot of confidence that that we'll be seeing him this series, especially if, you know, if it goes the way game one went, which I guess, by the way, before we dive fully into game one, we did just get an update on Jared Vanderbilt, who had an injury that was gruesome enough that, I mean, you guys saw the bench reaction from the Thunder players.
Yeah. That was gnarly.
That was crazy.
Bone popping out of the finger, but JJ Redick just said he's day to day. That's surprising to me, but I'm not a doctor. I don't know exactly how they heal all these things, but dislocated finger, bone broke the skin, nasty. You knew from the reaction of the bench, the reaction of Jared Vanderbilt, and when the training staff initially came over and put the towel over his hand, you knew right then and there it's something bad, whatever happened. But again, maybe a little bit of good news there, Jovan, that it's a day-to-day situation right now with Jared Vanderbilt.
Yeah, I mean, he only played 6 minutes, but I thought you felt his impact out there in the six-minute shift. I mean, JJ used the term putting his finger back together like it was some Frankenstein contraption or something. So, yeah, I mean, Vando's a tough dude, and seeing him, like, seeing his reaction, that just, like, guttural exhale and screaming, it was like, you know, that's one of the toughest dudes on the team, in the league. And seeing him react like that, clearly he was in excruciating pain. And at the time, we didn't know because we couldn't see it. But obviously, the bone was sticking out of his finger. So, I mean, if he's able to play in game two, kudos to him and just how tough he is. I feel like game two is probably off the table, but maybe he could return for game three or game four. Day to day with the Lakers, you never know. Kendrick Nunn was day to day for a full season, but you never know what it's going to mean. But like, if he can return at all at this series, just based on what happened, like that's big shout out to Vando.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's the offhand, it's the pinky on his offhand, I think that's fine. Like, I was showing you guys, I have a dislocated pinky on my offhand as well that I've
redislocated. Got the Sean Marion finger.
Yeah. I literally have to tape it every time I play, because if you hit it like this, I had a couple times in a row where I was playing and, like, when I was driving to the rim, people were like swiping down at the ball and like redislocated. So now I tape it every single time because there's like no ligaments there, but it's literally your offhand pinky. If there was one finger to chop off, it would be that one as a basketball player. Not that you want to, but the point is like, I wasn't entirely surprised that Vando was going to be back sooner than later.
Can you just, is it to the point now where you can just pop it back in whenever it happens?
I literally pop it in myself. Yeah. And it's more mentally unsettling than it is physically unsettling, because you look down and, like, I've looked down and it's been like sideways off the side of the knuckle, but you just pull on it like really hard and it just kind of pops back into place. But yeah, I my wife actually has the exact same injury because she played basketball as well. And we both joke that, like, when we're 65, we're going to have the worst arthritis in our pinkies that you could possibly imagine.
Dislocations, certainly no fun. Hopefully Jared Vanderbilt is back, and Jason, hopefully that's nothing you have to go through again here with your pinky pointing the wrong direction. Let's get to last night's game. The Lakers do lose 108-90, just 90 points put up He had 19 points in the third quarter, 18 points in the fourth. Obviously, we'll talk about the offense a bit, but Jovan, why don't we start with you on this? What are your big picture overall takeaways of what happened with the Lakers in last night's game?
Well, I'll start positive here just because I feel like we all need some collective optimism here. So I think first and foremost, the defensive game plan against Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, I thought the Lakers executed it specifically on him at a high level. I thought there were clearly mistakes out of the initial coverage against Shai, but they clearly wanted to limit Shai in terms of just even getting shots on goal. And they did a good job of that. Only 15 field goal attempts for Shai. They held him to a season low 18 points. We all know about the 20-point streak. He beat Wilt Chamberlain this season, and last time he scored under 20 was last postseason against the Timberwolves in Game 3 of the Conference Finals. So you have to go back nearly a year for the last time Shai did not reach 20 points in a regular season or playoff game. So LA holds him to a season low in points. They also force a season high in turnovers. His previous high in turnovers this season was 5. They forced him into 7. Also the second most turnovers he's had in a playoff game. So from like doing their job against Shai, I think there was a lot to be encouraged by. And it was a pretty aggressive scheme. They were throwing in a lot of doubles, a lot of attention. I mean, I went back and rewatched all of his possessions, and there was times there was 4 guys basically like within arm's reach of Shai. And the downside to that scheme was we saw there was times he split the doubles, or there was times whenever he was able to pass out of it, all of a sudden OKC was playing with an advantage. And a big difference between OKC and Houston is OKC knows how to play with an advantage and they will make you pay. And you saw, whereas Houston, it's these fumbled passes, it's these like, airballing threes and stuff. OKC is like, no, we're getting to the rim, we're getting dunks, we're getting layups, we're getting wide open kick out threes, and we're going to make you pay. So, well, I thought they won the battle against Shai. They ultimately lost the war, and I think they're going to have to recalibrate how aggressive they were with that scheme, because, again, some of these possessions where it's 3 or 4 guys selling out against Shai directly, at some point you just don't have enough on the back line, and I thought they really lost parts of this game because of that. Other big positive for me was LeBron. I thought LeBron was arguably the best player on the floor. I mean, certainly the best Laker, but someone in the chat last night on my show said they felt Chet was the best player just because of the defense and the rebounding in comparison to LeBron. But I think, based on who had what horses on what side and the caliber of defense LeBron was going, I would make the case that LeBron was the best player on the floor. Continued his play from the Houston series, just dominating them in the post with bully ball, and even Lu Dort. Like, it just, no one has the size or strength to match up with LeBron in this series. I don't think J-Dub does, even if he comes back. Really, it's like you almost have to put Isaiah Hartenstein or the big Jalen Williams on him, but obviously he's got the speed and athleticism advantage against those guys. So, like, they have a real LeBron problem. But after that, it starts, like, I thought Rui played well for the most part. I think defensively, some of his rotations were late, and some of the trapping and stuff could have been better. DA, really strong first half. I thought he had a subpar, to say the least, second half. Made his first 5 shots, missed his final 7, started fumbling passes and not catching stuff. And, like, I just don't think, struggled with foul trouble. Don't think he had a good second half. Marcus, good defense overall. Some good playmaking, but 4 for 15 shooting. And then, of course, we have an entire segment dedicated to Austin, but just disaster performance from Austin, 3 for 16. So that's where I start to veer into the negatives of my biggest negative from this is in the season series, LA had a 95.8 offensive rating against OKC that actually improved in the final game without most of their regulars. If you look at the actual games with Luka, LeBron, and Austin, that's even in the low 90s. Mm-hmm. Last night, they had a 95 offensive rating against this team. So we now have a 5-game sample size that, like, the Lakers just can't score at a reasonable level against this defense. You can chalk it up to shot luck. You could chalk it up to variance. You could chalk it up to JJ threw out last night that the Lakers won the expected score. And I'm like, that rings hollow because you just have not been able to keep it close with this team, with your regulars. You've not been able to score against them. So, like, you can win the expected score all you want, but if you continue to play like this, you're going to get swept. So I think my biggest concern right now is like they defended well enough to win the game, but can they score enough? And up to this point in the season, like the answer against OKC has been no.
I agree with you. I think they did defend well enough. It was the offensive side of the ball, both in terms of their execution, the way that they, as well as just their overall shot making, that was an issue. You know, it was interesting, Jason, was after the game, LeBron was asked about the offensive problems, and he said, well, yeah, we're missing, I'm paraphrasing, he said, we're missing a dude who averaged 37 points a game. Like, that's kind of a big deal. I think the counter to that is, of course, the last time Luka played the Thunder, the Lakers got blown off the floor in that game as well. Is it as simple as they're missing Luka? Is there a path forward here where they can get better? I mean, this is now going back into the Houston series where the Lakers offense just seems to be stuck in the mud.
So I was overwhelmingly pleased with the process for the Lakers yesterday. And the reason why I say that is I think that executing to near perfection is difficult under normal circumstances, but it becomes more difficult the closer you get to the finish line and the bigger the lead is, because it's mental focus as much as it is physical exertion. And I thought the Lakers took okay care of the basketball for about 2.5 quarters. And when they moved the ball through OKC's defense, they got pretty good looks. And as a result of that, we were looking at this game in the middle of the third quarter, and it was literally a 4-point game. And the defensive scheme, I thought, was overwhelmingly leading to a net positive. You know, one of the things that's been happening with the double teams is obviously you're going to concede some open catch-and-shoot looks, and OKC just continues to shoot preposterously well on catch-and-shoots against the Lakers. They were 12 for 26 last night. That's 46%. They were 45% in the regular season. And the Thunder are a good catch-and-shoot team, but they're not a 45% catch-and-shoot team. They've just been shooting outrageously well against the Lakers. And I think if you were imagining a game that they win in this series, the Lakers, it probably involves the Thunder shooting closer to their, like, kind of mid-high 30s on catch-and-shoots that they typically shoot. But what ends up happening is, like, a few payoff shots get missed. You know, a few sequences go against your like the 4-point play at the end of the third quarter, for example. And it's just like a shotgun blast to the chest. And all of a sudden you're down 12. And then you have a couple of sloppy turnovers to start the fourth. And it just snowballs from there. And like, I kind of imagine a different version of that game where the Thunder make like maybe 2 fewer catch and shoot threes. And Austin just makes some shots. And we're going to talk about Austin. Like Austin, I didn't think Austin got particularly good looks. And we'll dive into that a little bit. But Austin also fancies himself a $40+ million player. And $40+ million players sometimes hit tough shots. And so there's a certain version of like maybe Austin goes 7 for 16 instead of 3 for 16. And instead of being that being a 4-point game in the third quarter, maybe it's tied or the Lakers have a 2-point lead and the Lakers are able to kind of hold on to the rope, so to speak, with their execution a little bit longer. And it turns into a closer game late. And so I'll be honest with you, like I saw many versions of last night's game in my head beforehand where they just got their ass kicked. So like, you know, for obvious reasons. So like, there were stretches of that game where it's like LeBron's running inverted action, Marcus slipping out, you get a pretty good look. Oh, they're running this ball screen skip, Rui's wide open in the corner, knock down three. There was parts of the game where you're like, the Lakers can move the ball through this team and get some good looks. They just didn't get enough out of Austin. They got nothing out of Austin, really. Marcus was off with his jump shot. And there's a little bit of like Marcus needs to chill out with these pull-up jump shots. That's killing me a little bit. Like, as a team,
he had 2 pull-up threes. I went back and rewatched all the shots. He had 2 pull-up threes with 18 on the shot clock. You cannot have that.
Yeah,
that,
what are you doing? Like,
I don't understand it.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Jovan. Like, I was watching those, and I'm like, first of all, it's not our game for this team. Like, I like Austin shooting them, and that's about it. I like LeBron when he gets a bad under, like a dare you type of pull-up three. But like, that's really about it. They were, as a team, 4 for 18 on pull-up jump shots yesterday. So, like, some of that is process. Some of that is Austin's got to hit a few more than he did. But, like, the way I look at it, there's certainly things to get cleaned up. There's types of turnovers that have – like, stop having Jake LaRavia dribble against this team. Seriously. Like, that was a huge problem in the regular season, and it was a huge problem last night. We talked about it. We literally talked about it on Monday. Jake Laravia dribbling against this team. Like, Jackson, even though he's a good short roll passer against everyone else, like, kind of struggles to pass against this team. There's Ayton catching the ball in traffic that he continues to struggle with. This, the pocket passes, the lazy pocket passes against this team have been a problem all season. So I'm not going to sit here and pretend like there weren't things that were frustrating for me watching the game, but overwhelmingly, the defensive scheme was good and well executed. The Thunder just shot really well again. Tip of the cap to them. LeBron James, legitimate. He was the best player on the floor. Sorry, Chet was awesome. Go watch all of his made baskets. Like, literally, 2/3 of them were standing dunks underneath the basket that other people set him up with. Like, that's not to shit on Chet. Chet's a very good basketball player. I have a huge amount of respect for him. And frankly, like, a center who can space the floor the way he does vertically and from the three-point line while also being a top three defensive player in the league is an immensely valuable player. But LeBron James was going against a transcendently great defense and was basically comfortable as hell everywhere. Like, he had Alex Caruso on him for a good stretch of the second half, and he cooked Alex Caruso on and off the ball. He was posting him up easy. He was driving through his chest. Every time he went to help, I actually love the idea of running action elsewhere when a Caruso's on LeBron, because Caruso has a tendency to want to roam, and LeBron is just too good at that. He beat him on the offensive glass. He beat him with a back cut. Like, LeBron was doing serious damage to the Thunder, and he did look like the best player on the floor last night. So, like, there's a lot of positive. I just think in order for the Lakers to hang on to the rope longer, they need Austin to actually provide some scoring, and they need the Thunder to miss some shots. If they do, it can be close enough to where towards the end of the game, maybe LeBron can make some plays and the Thunder go cold and you can steal a game. But everything was good in terms of the process for the most part for me last night.
I agree with what you're saying about LeBron. I thought LeBron was fantastic. LeBron came out with the right mindset. He was aggressive from the get-go. And that is one of the Lakers' advantages, is the size on the wings. There was a possession, I believe it was Cason Wallace, that got stuck against LeBron in the block, and he just scored right over it, like, instantly. And Dignald had to take a timeout and try to readjust things. But I thought LeBron was great taking advantage of that. When you look at the areas where the Lakers actually can affect the Thunder and have some edges against them, LeBron James really leaned into those things, and he did a great job. Again, knocked down a couple of threes early, which is an area that I think we can talk about moving forward to. I actually think they needed to shoot more threes, but LeBron was very aggressive shooting the three early in the game as well. I thought he played a phenomenal game. I think he was the best player on the floor in the game, and that says a lot for a dude who's 41 years old, playing with the reigning MVP, playing with a guy like Chet Holmgren, playing with all the talent the Thunder have, and LeBron was the best guy on the floor. I thought he was fantastic, but there is a lot for the Lakers to clean up. And you're right, Jason, some of it does come down to the Thunder shot making. It was fantastic. There was also, I think, a speed advantage that the Thunder certainly enjoyed during the course of this game. You talked about, you know, Jackson Hayes and his passing out of the post or in kickout situations not being as good against OKC. A lot of that is they're so fast. They're shooting those passing lanes and picking off those passes before he's able to really throw them. It's also a swarming element to the defense that then makes the Lakers uncomfortable. I felt like guys like Luke Kennard, certainly Austin Reeves, they were sped up for much of the game, including their shooting, but also just handling the basketball. And that's part of what makes the Thunder so good, is their ability to do that and really throw you off. There is an element, though, where the Thunder hit some shots that maybe they won't hit all series long. I also thought there was a big gap, though, between the Thunder's bench and the Lakers bench. And you saw a number of guys on the Thunder. You talk about Jeremy Cain. There was even a play, I believe it was to end the half, where Isaiah Joe was able to get on the dribble, get into the paint, and hit just a picture-perfect floater right at the buzzer. And I'm doing the live play-by-play, and I'm just shaking my head. And I'm like, the Lakers don't have anybody that's coming off their bench that has the ability to do what some of these Thunder guys did. So I thought that also was an issue for the Lakers when it came to depth. Like, the Thunder were running an 11-man rotation and doing it legitimately because they had that many players. Even with Jalen Williams out, they had that many players they could throw on the floor that could be successful in their matchups against the Lakers. So I thought that was something that really stuck out, was just the overall depth of the Thunder compared to this was a game where I felt like the Lakers, how many guys could you really trust on the floor? That number seemed to really dwindle as the game went on.
Isaiah Joe was amazing.
Yeah.
If you take Vando out of the rotation for the next game or two, it's like you're now down to Luke, Jake, and Jackson as the three bench guys. And when you contrast that with Alex Caruso, Kayson Wallace, Isaiah Joe, Jared McCain, even Jalen Williams came in, you know, hit a three and I you know, gave them seven rebounds. Like I mean, it's, and then eventually if J-Dub's back, AJ Mitchell, who he was my X factor from the Thunder side going into the game. And he was probably, I would say, the fourth best player on the floor behind LeBron, Chet and Shea in that order, in my opinion. Like, I mean, yeah, OKC, I thought they had the top end advantage and they also had the bench depth advantage.
We need to talk a little bit about, can the Lakers offense improve from here? And I know we touched upon it a bit here. Before I get to, I do just want to make one quick comment here. I am often very quick to criticize officials. I thought the officiating was just fine in last night's game. There were moments that you can certainly pick out and all that. I don't think the officials had any impact on the outcome of the game. And I actually give them a lot of credit. There's a lot of highlight reels going around or low light reels going around. I thought they did a phenomenal job for the most part, not falling for the Shai Gilgeous-Alexander flails in the paint.
He tried it.
That highlight reel is pitiful. Turnovers.
He tried.
And I want to give that crew, you know, I want to give that crew some credit where credit is due.
They combined for 25 free throw attempts, which these are two of the highest foul drawing teams in the league. And to your guys' points, like, yeah, I thought there was at least three possessions. I think three, but I would have to, I haven't completed my rewatch yet, but three possessions where Shai tried to oversell the contact or flop, whatever you want to say. And I think two of those were just missed shots, and one of them was a turnover. And so I thought they did a pretty good job of, I mean, what, he only took three free throws last night. So, I mean, they kept him in check. And yeah, I think the officiating crew did about as well as possible.
Yeah, that's not to say they got everything. Of course, I'm seeing in the chat some people are mentioning, you know, oh, they missed this call, whatever. That's going to happen. That's to be expected. I thought overall over the course of the game, they did a good job. All right, we do need to talk a little bit about the offense. Of course, that will, we can kind of merge the offensive struggles with Austin Reaves because a lot of those two things go hand in hand. But first, let's give a shout out to our sponsor, and that is Prize Picks. You guys have heard us talk about Prize Picks before. Use the code HMA, play $5, get $50 instantly. Link is in the description down below. We'll take a look at some of the games tonight. Guys, no Joel Embiid for the 76ers tonight. Unfortunately, a number of injuries. Do you like that Paul George then? 2.5 three-pointers made. Is he going to have to get extra shots up because Joel Embiid is out?
Probably. Okay. I like that one.
Let's go there. Or do you like Paul George 11.5 points better?
Did they have Paul George 11.5 points?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, yeah. That one.
I'd go that.
I like that too. Okay, let's go with that one.
I think Victor over 5.5 block shots is not a terrible bet, just considering the Wolves seem very much intent on continuing to attack him for whatever that's worth.
I like that, especially if he's allowed to. I thought he got away with some goal tents. The Wolves certainly thought he did too, but nonetheless, he's a shot blocking monster.
Yeah, he blocked 12 shots, but the Wolves, like a bunch of their final baskets were at the rim. Like they just never stopped going at him the entire game. It was crazy.
I like the Wolves were throwing in the Gortat screens, but we'll see what they can do against him. But I think we got a good card here. If you guys want to get in on it, use that code HMA. Link is in the description down below. Play $5, get $50. It's $10 entry, win you $27. Again, link in the description. And a big thank you to Prize Picks for sponsoring today's show. All right, guys. The offense, let's just do offensive struggles / Austin Reaves. Obviously, Austin, horrible game. 3-for-16 shooting. I thought he looked completely off rhythm. I thought the timing of his shots, not only was he not generating the kinds of shots he needed, when his decisions on when to shoot, I thought, looked completely off. There were moments where he looked rushed. Part of that is you give OKC credit for their screen navigation. There was one play in particular where Kayson Wallace was able to just navigate the hell out of a screen, get to the spot, and then block Austin. It was just a phenomenal defensive read by him, and Austin got a shot blocked there. 0-for-5 from 3, 2-for-17 since coming back from injury. He looked all out of sorts, couldn't get anything to drop. I thought he did a decent job early, spraying the ball out to shooters and picked up some assists that way, but even had a few bad turnovers, stepped on the line on one of them on the sideline. That was, I believe, the Lakers' first or second turnover of the game. Just a mess of a performance from Austin Reaves, who definitely needed a lot more for in this one. Jovan, let's start with you. Lakers offense / Austin Reaves, what did you see from this, and are improvements coming here?
Well, I think we have to focus on Austin. You know, we already touched on some of the offensive stuff. I think there is a macro problem here.
Marcus's pull-ups and then the turnovers were really the only other couple things, and we already hit on that. I think for we sure. go right
yeah,
to Austin.
Like, to me, this is an Austin conversation. And look, I said this last night on my show, and I'm going to reiterate it. I know people expect me to come on here and defend him or justify it or make some sort of injury excuse. I'm not. I think this was indefensible, that there was no justification for the performance last night. To my memory, that was the worst playoff game I've ever seen him play. And this is now a concerning trend against, I guess, a certain caliber of defense, but specifically this defense. And this team is not going anywhere. This team is going to be in the Lakers' path for the next 5 years. And if you're trying to win a championship with Luka Doncic over the next half decade, you're going to have to go through OKC at some point, including this year, if the Lakers want to win a championship. And Austin just has not been good enough against the Thunder. Going back to the season series, averaged 15 points, 4 rebounds, 4 assists, which is below his season averages, but shot 43% and 23% on threes. So you follow that up. Last night, goes 0-for-5 on threes. It is now shooting 12% in the playoffs on threes, which would be 3 consecutive postseasons where he's been 32% or worse from deep. And it's like, I think there's a 3-point shooting concern here with him now over multiple postseasons. But really, I think if you take a step back on that, it's like how his body has held up over the course of the season and playing 70 plus games and 35 plus minutes. Like, I think he has worn down each of the last 3 postseasons. And I think that the Lakers have seen that directly, and it has affected his numbers, particularly his jumper. Like, that's been the biggest thing for me since he's come back, is just the jumper is not there. And we can chalk that up to he missed a month. We could chalk it up to the condition. Whatever you want to chalk it up to, it doesn't matter. Because if you're out there, even if you are injured or playing through injury or just coming back off injury, you need to produce. And like, that was even the thing I thought last year with the Austin conversation was like, we found out after the fact, okay, he has this toe injury. He wasn't 100%. But if you're going to play through it and you're going to be out there, then what ultimately matters is the results. Like, we can give him a golf clap for playing through injury and being available. But at the end of the day, like, what matters most is the results and what you're producing. And like, they need far more from him. He was my X factor on the Lakers side. I said that he needed to be the third best player on the floor, if not matching Chet for being the third best player on the floor. And he wasn't even the third best Laker last night. I mean, you can make a case he wasn't even the fifth best Laker last night, right? So he needs to be at a much higher level. Now, in terms of ways I think LA can get him going, I did not like a lot of the high pick and roll. I thought they were able to corral him and keep him in check and force him into some contested pull-up mid-range jumpers, or even he got downhill a couple times. But with the help and the swarming, you rarely are getting an open look in the half court at the rim against the Thunder. So I think he could still bring the ball up the floor, still get the Lakers into their sets. But where I thought he had a sliver of success, I'm not saying he was successful, but a sliver of success here was some of the off-ball stuff. So there was a flare action that they ran where he comes off the flare screen, he gets it and rips immediately, gets downhill against Kayson Wallace. And before Isaiah Hartenstein can rotate over, he floats up a floater that banks in. So actions like that, then they also had some empty side pick and roll actions or empty corner where there's no one no shooter in the corner and you're running a two-man game with he ran it a couple times with Luke, a couple times with LeBron, a couple times with Marcus. And the goal is to get, if they're hiding a smaller defender on Luke or Marcus, get that guy switched onto Austin, and Austin can attack that guy. Or if it's LeBron, you're getting the smaller guy switched onto LeBron, then you hit LeBron, go into a post-up. So I think they do have to change the strategy with Austin and how he's attacking. I think the give him the ball 40 feet from the basket, run a high pick and roll, try to attack the Thunder defense. It did not work in the regular season consistently enough. It certainly did not work in game one. I think they have to change the approach here, where it's Austin off ball, getting him an advantage coming off of a screen or coming off of some sort of action to get him in motion and leverage his speed. And then also some empty corner side pick and rolls where it's more of a two-man game and there's less defensive attention shifted over. So those would be my two quickest fixes for Austin offensively. But at the end of the day, I think he was like 2 for 7 within 5 feet of the basket. That's got to be much better. That's got to be 4 for 7, 5 for 7. Some of the pull-up middies, some of the pull-up threes, taking contested shots. I mean, if you're going to, as Jason said earlier, you want to make $40 million, you got to make those shots. So he's got to be better all around. But yeah, I mean, I think like for the Lakers to have any chance of winning a game in this series, let alone like winning the series, Austin needs to be 25 plus on like reasonable efficiency. And if he's putting up 8-point games and like setting like Lakers records for lowest field goal percentage for 15 plus field goals, like Lakers are getting swept.
Yeah. 100%. I agree with everything you said. What is Austin's superpower as a player? What's his thing? It's efficient scoring. That's been his thing. Nearly 50% from the field this season. It's being able to get points going to the free throw line. It's efficiency scoring the basketball and executing very well out of the pick and roll. He was none of that in last night's game. It was a disaster performance. There's no getting around it. It was awful. And I think part of the problem, we look at, well, where was he able to find some success against Houston last series? Well, they would run the pick and roll, and then he got to just eviscerate Şengün, right, and get to the rim. And we saw that, 8 points in the third quarter, game six, and it was just Austin at the rim finishing because the jumper is not working right now. So you don't get that against OKC. OKC forced him into being a jump shooter, and they also defend that pick and roll very, very well. And if the jumper's not falling, he doesn't really have a counter to the way OKC is defending them and the skill set that OKC has. And he played right into that, continued taking tough shots that was not knocking them down. I think it got into his head. I thought we saw him mentally break during this game where you could see he was getting frustrated with himself. I thought his whole shot process was being thrown off. Like I said, it was a mess. He's a player who is not a next level burst athlete. He operates well in the pick and roll in part because that's what gets him an advantage. He has to get shoulders past a defender, get the advantage, then he can make the read from there. He's not going to create that just by breaking down his man off the dribble all that often. He can from time to time, though. Frankly, I think turnovers are coming in a different way. He keeps crossing the ball over in front of Cason Wallace. He's going to get picked. He's going to get pick sixes. I think that's coming. But you're not going to get that edge against this OKC team. So how are you going to get him that advantage, that off ball curl that we've been talking about that he did have a little bit of success with? That's probably going to be what you're going to have to do because his bread and butter is the pick and roll. It's not nearly as successful against OKC specifically. And we could talk all about his shooting. He was bad all over the place in this game, but in terms of getting him opportunities to gain an advantage and then capitalize from that, it's going to have to come from other actions than just running that high pick and roll. Doesn't mean you go away from it completely, but you're going to have to run some other stuff if he's going to be able to take advantage of this Thunder defense. And even then, this Thunder defense is very, very good in ways that give Austin Reeves a lot of trouble. And he said it the best. OKC's not going anywhere. He's got to get this figured out. He's got to get this figured out. And if he can't, then that's a bigger conversation come July. Jason, let me get your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, you guys have hit most of it, so I won't add too much. I think there's two different versions of this conversation, which is the big picture conversation and then what do you do in this series. And the big picture conversation for me is I give him a lot of grace coming back from from an injury where he didn't have much chance to build a rhythm before going against this defense. Like that to me is like an underrated part of how difficult this is. However, at the same time, we just have a pretty extensive list of evidence now that Austin struggles in this matchup. So that's true too, regardless of how you feel about the rhythm. But in the big picture, while I agree it's something that Austin has to figure out, Austin is just a dude that has consistently made dramatic improvements year over year. So I just bet on him figuring it out. Now, whether or not it ends up hurting him in his contract negotiations this summer, that's another story. Uh-huh. But like, I think the Lakers should retain him basically no matter what. And from there, count on the fact that as he continues to improve year over year, he will eventually figure out how to be more successful against this matchup. Now, in the short term, in this series, I think Jovan made a really good point about the pick and roll. To me, there's like a live ball handling issue that he has in this matchup, where when Austin can play against a deep drop, and that deep drop big is either slow or not a great rim protector, he can absolutely fry, like we saw against Şengün, because he can either beat him with speed attacks or he can get to work in the mid-range. He just has a bunch of different ways that he can score in that situation. What OKC does that is an issue for him is they are very aggressive in ball screen actions with him. So like guard screens, they're switching hard with ball pressure. And then often in ball screens, they're meeting him up high with the big at closer to the level. That puts an emphasis on his playmaking ability. And it's not that Austin hasn't become better at that stuff, because he has. It's just this team in particular is a very difficult team to pass against. They just have super long arms. Even their bad defenders like Isaiah Joe and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander have long arms. And they're very good at pressuring the ball handler and making those passing angles very difficult. And like you saw a lot of like Austin coming off of a screen and then like whether it be a hedge from Isaiah Joe or a hard switch from Lu Dort where like he's panicking and like retreating back to like throw the pass because he's like freaking out a little bit as they get up in his space. And I talked about this on my show last night. I wonder if like a guy for him to watch for some solutions for this series and in the long run is actually like Steph, because Steph is a guy that faces a ton of super intense ball screen coverages where like guys are blitzing, aggressively jumping out on guard screens, aggressively jumping out to the level when the big's in the screen. And he has also in his career suffered from, I'm a little small and I'm a little unathletic. So when a bunch of really long athletic dudes start trapping me, I can sometimes turn the ball over. Steph has had that issue in his career. But Steph has gotten really good at, one, like Jovan said, using off-ball action instead of just live dribble all the time. So it's a little bit easier for him to kind of catch on the run so that it's harder to stop him in those situations. And then two, he's found a lot of like touch passing angles to get rid of the basketball. And he has a chemistry with his screeners to where he kind of knows where to throw those balls. And so he'll have a lot of success that way. So I wonder if Steph's a guy that he can watch. I also really like him in ISO in this matchup. This dawned on me in the game back in LA. Like when he can kind of get to cooking one-on-one and he doesn't have to worry about the second defender, it allows him to kind of focus on his individual game. And I like the triple threat too. One of the buckets he had in Cason Wallace on the left wing was triple threat. So he doesn't have to expose a ball to Cason. He hit him with the exact same move that he hit Andrew Wiggins with the game winner on Christmas Day. Just like a hard jab right and go, which puts an emphasis on his speed. And he actually has a little bit of size on Cason Wallace. So like I think simplifying things for him on ball with like ISOs and triple threat. And then like Jovan said, more off ball action so that he can catch on the run rather than with a live dribble would go a long way. But I remain committed to Austin long term. I just think when you start to look around at look at how much Desmond Bane struggled in the last round. Look at how much like Jamal Murray struggled in the last round. Like these are all dudes that Jamal Murray makes $50 million. Like Desmond Bane was traded for 4 first round picks. Like all of these skill guards are kind of struggling a bit in how physical these playoffs are. And Austin's coming back from an injury, and he's top of the scouting report on the perimeter because of the absence of Luka Doncic. So, like, I still bet on Austin long-term as the right partner for Luka.
He definitely has to be better. There's a lot of truth in what you're saying. He's got to be better out there in terms of shooting, his efficiency, all of that. My hope, obviously, is that this is the floor for the series for him, and that he can be significantly better from here and start to actually make headway against this type of team. We did see him absolutely tear up Minnesota this season. He has had some teams that he's had some success against. Finding against OKC, this is going to be a real challenge for him, and we'll see if he can get there or not, if he can start to make these adjustments and get to be where certainly the Lakers need him to be. We do need to get into our chat questions and comments here in just a moment. First, let's give a shout out to a sponsor. We'll be right back in 1 minute.
All right, quick break. And this one's actually something I've been using personally. Cold days, big games, busy schedule, no time to cook. That's why I've been rocking with Factor. I've been ordering their Protein Plus meals, especially the grilled chicken with roasted veggies. Perfect for me because I'm trying to keep my energy high for shows without feeling heavy after eating. What I like about Factor, quality ingredients, lean proteins, real veggies, whole food fats, no refined sugars, no artificial sweeteners, no refined seed oils, and it fits the schedule. They've got 100 rotating meals weekly, keto, calorie smart, Mediterranean, GLP-1 support, even a new Muscle Pro collection for strength and recovery. And the convenience is crazy. Always fresh, never frozen, ready in about 2 minutes, no prep, no stress. I use this, and you guys should too, especially if you're balancing work, school, gym, and Lakers games every night. Head to factormeals.com/LakersPod50off and use code LakersPod50off to get your 50% off your first box plus free breakfast for a year. That's 50% off and a free breakfast item in every box for a year while your subscription is still active.
Lost you on for a second. Did you go to start your Factor meal so it's ready after the show?
Yes. Yes, I did.
All right. Let's jump into some of our questions, some of our comments here. Let's start here. Not going to win the series, but last night felt like a very winnable game and gave me false hope. Need to push our bench back three spots this offseason. This is something I've been talking about a bit, that it's not just about replacing some bench play. You have to actually add depth to this roster. That's going to be one of the challenges, I think, for Rob Pelinka. And it's true against a lot of teams, but especially against OKC, it really stands out, guys, how much depth OKC has compared to what the Lakers are throwing out there. I really thought the bench was a big separator in this game.
I could not agree more. I think the Lakers have four areas they need to improve on. Well, we could actually throw out even more, but in general, like depth, I think they've had guys slotted in higher positions than they should be for a while now, I think going on multiple years. So certainly back end roster depth, but I would even argue, like, even within their current bench, I think most of their bench would be middle to back end bench guys on contenders rather than like high end bench guys on contenders. Then obviously defense, athleticism, shooting. And I think we saw all of that in game one where OKC had the deeper bench. LA was not able to create a margin with their shooting. And, you know, they both took 33s, low volume game. OKC shot, 13 for 30. LA went 10 for 30. The defense, just as good as it was not as good as OKC's defense. And then the athleticism, like, when I went back and watched Shea's 15 field goal attempts, I had to double check that it wasn't 2x speed, because I was like, this dude is just blasting through double teams and past the initial line of defense at a level that I was like, this doesn't seem like these two teams are playing the same game right now. And it was just, he was blown by dudes left and right. So there's also a speed component that the Lakers are gonna have to figure out moving forward.
That point that Jovan's making too, like, this was something that I thought dawned on me in the Celtics series, where it's like abundantly clear that they don't have like a perimeter player other than Jaylen Brown who can like pressure the rim at all. And it's just it's a fundamental part of like breaking the defense down. So like, look at the Tyrese Maxey possessions at the end of game seven, where no one can make a jump shot for like a 5 minute straight period for either team. Even Embiid goes cold, except for that one three he hit. And, you know, Pritchard's missing open corner threes, and Jaylen Brown's missing open threes and open mid-rangers. And then Tyrese just toasts everybody off the dribble for a couple of layups late in the game. Look at like how big Jamal Shedd was for big stretches of the Toronto series. Look at like AJ Mitchell and just how he immediately is a useful player for OKC because he can beat people off the dribble. Look at how, I mean, I'd even include Austin in this when he, you know, is in the right role, when he's in the right kind of like a spot where he's attacking off of a compromised defense or when he's being guarded by a lesser defender because Luka's out there. There's a certain amount of like value in modern NBA. Minnesota's the last example I'll use. Jaden McDaniels pressures the rim. Terrence Shannon pressures the rim. Anthony Edwards pressures the rim. Ayo Dosunmu pressures the rim. Julius Randle pressures the rim. Even Naz Reid to a certain extent. Like, there's a certain amount of like I think the Lakers need two or three additional athletes that really pressure the rim as slashers, either on ball or driving closeouts like Jaden. Like Jaden does it a lot, just driving closeouts. But like it, there's just such a premium on that in the NBA right now. Like having dudes who can beat that first line of defense and make everybody react in one way or another. It like opens up rebounding opportunities too as everyone collapses. It opens up the kick out threes that are higher quality threes. Like I think it just kind of stems back to that weakness in the Lakers roster and overall athleticism.
You're absolutely right. They do need those players. The key though being those players also need to be able to shoot the basketball. And those players also need
not necessarily though. Like Jaden McDaniels is 2 for 20 from three this postseason. And he's been literally one of the top like 7 or 8 dudes in the entire playoff field. Like I don't mean to poo-poo your point, Trevor, because like
sure.
you do need to be able to shoot to a certain extent. But like I would argue having a dude who can knock down a three but can't do anything else athletically is way less valuable in this environment than a dude who shoots 32% from three but that can slash and handle the ball a little bit. Like,
imagine
if Jared Vanderbilt, forget about the threes. Imagine if Jared Vanderbilt could just like do some of the Jaden McDaniels stuff where like he could slalom in the lane and hit a little 10-footer and like credibly finish around the rim in traffic. Like, I think there's a higher premium on the rim. Terrence Shannon, he's hit a couple threes in this postseason run, but he's not winning these games by hitting threes. He's winning by slashing.
I think that player doesn't necessarily have to be a knockdown 3-point shot. We're not talking like 40%+. We're not talking that type of, we're talking the defense has to care that they're out there, and specifically on a Luka team, right? You need as much floor spacing as you can get as possible. You need a big that can roll to the rim, that can soar and catch lobs and throw those down. That's what you need around Luka. Now, if you have somebody that once Luka does get that penetration into the paint and kicks out, and that player can attack a closeout, get to the rim, or even just make a slash, a cut to the rim and get the drop-off pass from Luka, that's fantastic. You just have to have the bare minimum respect of the defense out there. That's what I'm talking about. A player that you
like can't be a Star Thompson or Jared Vanderbilt, to your point. Yeah, exactly. I agree with you in that. I think the line for that is like can make it about a third of the time. Like
sure.
I don't think I think like a for instance, like would you rather have right now Terrence Shannon or Luke Kennard?
Oh, Terrence Shannon.
Yeah, so that's kind of the general point that I make. But I do agree with you, Trevor. Like, for the record, to make your point, Asar Thompson on the floor was how the Cavs got back in the game. And then they took him off the floor and they immediately took over because they spaced the floor and were able to generate shots. So you're correct. I'm making a point more about, like, how valuable slashing is.
For sure. All right, let's go to this one here. It said, Smart outplayed his contract. Resign if he opts out for over $15 million a year. 32 years old, likely won't be able to replicate this season. Consider level play, health availability with injury history. So there's a couple things that I have no concerns about with Marcus Smart. I have no concerns about his defensive acumen. I have no concerns about him in the team's structure, the team culture. He is a leader on the floor. I have no concerns about his Marcus Smart going to bust his ass every single night. No concerns there. I do have concerns about the injury history with him. I think he's been a critical, frankly, I think they need, if you could get three more Marcus Smarts, that would be fantastic. It's part of the reason why losing Jordan Goodwin to get Marcus Smart hurt. Not that getting Marcus Smart was the bad move, it's that you could have used Jordan Goodwin and Marcus Smart would have been nice to have both of those players on this team. However, I do have concerns when we look at what the length of the next contract and the total paid out on the contract. I do have concerns about the injury history that comes with them. So I don't know. Jovan, you were kind of the leader of the Start Smart push. Obviously that worked out very, very well. I've become a huge fan of his game. Where are you at?
I was on the right side of history on that one. But yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to the years for me. I think if you're looking at a 4-year deal, if he wants like the long-term security of I'm in my early 30s, I've dealt with injuries the last few years, I want some long-term security here. I think you can leverage that total down to maybe in that range, I'm maybe more at like $12 million a year, right? Which is probably lower than he wants, and honestly lower than he deserves. But it's like, mm-hmm. if you want a 4-year deal as a 32-year-old, I think that that's like a more appropriate range, because you don't want to be looking at that 3 years from now and being like, we just had this $18 million Marcus Smart, $20 million Marcus Smart contract. He's 34. He hasn't stayed healthy the last couple of years, and you're just in a tough spot. So I would be open. Like, I think 15-ish is fair, and that honestly might even be low for like the actual production and value you're getting. Like, I mean, he has at times like single-handedly carried the Lakers defense. And I think from like a leadership and locker room perspective, it's just invaluable, the impact he's had on this group. So I think you could even talk me into higher, but I think if you're going over 15, even into like that 17, 18 range, I think it should be a 2-year deal. And maybe it's something like 2 years, $35 million, where you give him a little bit of a bump, but it's shorter term. If you go out to 3 years, maybe that's like 345, right? So 3 years, $45 million, you're around average 15 or so. And then if you go to 4, it drops it a little bit. So I think to me, it just comes down to how many years does he want? And based on that, you get more guaranteed money, but it's at a lower annual value. If he wants the shorter term deal, I'm fine bumping that up and, you know, just making it more of like a short term. We'll lock you in at a high number, but it's got to be, we got to have some flexibility here. So I think it really just depends on what type of deal he wants in terms of the length. And then you go from there.
He played 62 games this season. Last season played 34 games. The season before that played in 20 games. Not great with the injury history for him, but a critical piece to this team. Frankly, they need more players like Marcus Smart, 100%. There's no doubt. He is he's the kind of guy that you want on this team. If he were to pick up that player option, it would be a huge win for the Lakers. I can tell you that much. If I'm his agent, I would not be telling him to pick up the player option. I'd be looking to try to get more security for the long haul. The only thing I can even think the Lakers could try to, and I do not expect this to work, but try to sell him on, hey, next year we'll have early bird rights on you, and we can take care of you at that point if you pick up the player option this year, something to that effect. But even then, I would be trying to get the long-term security if I'm Marcus Smart. But I do think he's an important piece to this team, and it's going to be a big part of the fitting the puzzle pieces together that Rob Pelinka is going to have to do this summer when he's trying to figure out how to use that cap space. Let's go to this one. Reeves gave me PTSD. We are in denial.
PTSD low.
No, PTSD low. PTSD low.
Oh, no. That may be even worse there.
That is much worse than PTSD.
I forgot. I was doing something the other day, and I was looking at the Wizards cap sheet. And I went, oh, my God. I completely forgot D'Angelo Russell is technically a Washington Wizard right now. We are in the denial stage at this point. Is that the point we're at, that this is now D'Lo-esque with Austin Reeves? Or is that going too far?
I think it's going too far.
I agree.
D'Lo is worse. It wasn't just the offensive mistakes. It was like the defensive lapses and the overall lack of just give a shit on a possession-to-possession basis.
This one, Dames said, no point guarding Jake. He ain't going to shoot. Do you want him to shoot? I don't know about that. I have a signed Austin Reeves LA jersey, but yesterday he played for Home Depot. What hurts most is LA showed they can win. Yeah, I mean, I've seen people throw out there, well, if Austin shot 10 of 16, they win the game. Well, yeah, that's also an insanely above average shooting game. Yes, had Austin played, I thought both the backcourt in general shot very poorly, both Austin and Smart. The difference was Smart gives you so much on the defensive side of the ball, whereas Austin is just, he tops out as a maybe okay defensive player at times, and sometimes he's not good. But as far as Jake LaRavia goes, yeah, it was a mess. It to have two turnovers, and I want to say he played 11 minutes. They were sloppy turnovers. I've seen a lot of people, guys, suggesting, well, you know, play Bronny over Jake. The only issue that I've got with that is we're talking about two totally different positions. Bronny being a guard and Jake being a wing, and you're looking for two different things from them. A lot of people jump to, well, this player over there that's on the bench would play better than this guy would. Sometimes position matters. Jason, where are you at with Jake LaRavia at this point? Especially assuming Jared Vanderbilt is not a go for tomorrow. Are you trying to replace some of his minutes? Has he been so bad that you start playing smaller and try a Nick Smith Jr., a Bronny James, whoever, or do you just continue to feed minutes to LaRavia and hope that the good moments outweigh the bad?
I don't think this is a series for the Lakers' smaller guards the way that it was in the last round. Specifically with Jake, one of the things that I think is important is his positional size and overall ability to execute a defensive scheme is very valuable in their pursuit of stopping Shea and getting just stops in general. Do I wish he would dribble? Yes. Do I wish he would dribble less? Yes.
No.
Do I wish he would dribble? No, exactly. But other than that specifically, I think like there's an overall like length and size advantage that I think is valuable with the Lakers double teaming, that I think just Jake has a better chance of executing his part of the scheme. And so I think his minutes are kind of hard to replace by a Bronny or a Nick Smith in this matchup.
All right, let's go here. Same shit, different day. Austin Reeves getting absolutely torched in the Lakers sphere. This is starting to become a pattern with him. Is the slander justified?
I'm on the 50-yard line with this. Like,
yeah.
He's been so bad against OKC for so long that he deserves criticism. I just don't think it changes my personal opinion about his fit long-term with the team. Like, the only time I would consider trading Austin is if I was, one, getting back a ball handler that I knew was going to be better. So, like, I've talked to you guys, like, if the Cavs got shredded by the Pistons and you called up Kobe Altman and you were like, hey, dude, here's Austin Reeves and two first-round picks in a sign-and-trade for Donovan Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of, like, stuff that's complicated there because the Cavs would have to shed salary and there's like it's more difficult than it looks like on the surface. But like if you were getting, I'm more just meaning it as like a thought exercise. If the Lakers were getting back a Donovan Mitchell level ball handler, sure. Or if they were getting back multiple high level two-way starters, like if they were getting, say, like again, just a thought exercise because the Wolves would never do this. But if you were getting back a Jaden McDaniels, or a, you know, but Jaden plus another high level player, like a, let's say it's Jaden plus a, you know, a TJ Shannon, or it's a Herb Jones plus a Trey Murphy. Like if I thought I was getting back multiple high level players, that's great. I just think in the Luka construct, you need the secondary ball handler. And if you go get a couple of mediocre starters or mediocre two-way guys, but you don't have that secondary ball handler when LeBron retires, you just have a different problem. And so I think really with Austin, the bet on him is that he'll continue to improve like he has every single year. Like think about how much better he was this year than last year. And think [S2] Sure. [S1] About how much better he was last year than the year before. Like the dude does considerably get better every year. And I think that is what makes him kind of hard to replace in this current circumstance.
As far as is it justified? I think it is to a degree. There's levels to it though, right? Where did he play awful? Yes, he played awful. And that's, I mean, certainly a conversation that you got to have. And why did he play poor? Just like if a player plays great, fantastic. Let's talk about why a player played great. What happened? What was it allowed that player to play so well? Why did that player do such a great job in that game? Same thing with Austin. Austin was awful in this game. Why was he awful? Why was he terrible? I do think some of the reaction wipes away everything else that's happened over the course of the season. It focuses just on this. Like, do I buy that Austin Reeves is a 12% three-point shooter moving forward from here on out? So if he is, that's it. That's game over, right? I don't think that is reasonable. And that's some of the reaction, I think, goes a bit too far when you see the responses on social media. That said, we live in a world of the extremes. Everything is either the best thing ever or it is the absolute worst thing ever, and it is trash and needs to be ejected from whatever team they're on that you don't particularly like. That said, I do think it's the criticism is it's becoming a real thing in terms of him struggling in the playoffs, in terms of him struggling against these kinds of things. So it's very warranted criticism. I think sometimes people push that too far. Sometimes we lose sight of like the ultimate goal is for the Lakers to win games, right? That's the ultimate goal. And for the players on the team to do well. And there's that immediate emotional response of this player. And it's not just an Austin Reaves thing. This is with players in general. This player played poorly. This player hurt the team that I liked. Get this guy off of this team. And then the next game, if the player plays well, it's the opposite. And we ride that roller coaster. Sometimes it's a matter of staying a bit more grounded with those conversations. So it's not that the criticism isn't warranted. It absolutely is. He was terrible. He was awful. There's no excusing that, injury or not. He simply has to be better. I think sometimes the response gets a little out of hand, though, as far as what the reaction is. But then again, that's also social media and the way that goes. Let's go to this one. Jamal Murray won a chip. Don't want to hear it. Oh, Jay, I'm assuming that was to your comment, Jason, about other guards that have struggled in the playoffs this year.
Yeah, I think that Denver Nuggets team wins the title if Austin Reaves from this year is healthy and in rhythm next to Jokic.
I think Denver, this year's Denver Nuggets?
No, from 2023.
Oh, for 2020. Okay, gotcha.
Not to say, like, guys, I do think Jamal Murray is proven to be a better playoff player than Austin. My point is the point I was trying to make is, like, as the league has gotten more physical and the best teams in the league have been so good on defense, skill guards all around the league are struggling. Like, Jalen Brunson is really the only dude who's, like, thriving as, like, a small, unathletic on-ball guard in this environment.
And Jalen Brunson is very, very physically strong. That certainly helps him in that type of situation.
Good point. And I think that's part of we talked about that over the season, like when he was breaking down. Like, there is clearly another – Austin made improvements with his body. There's clearly another level with Austin's body that he needs to get to.
All right, let's we've got a couple more we're going to get to. First, one more shout out to a sponsor. We'll be back in 1 minute to get to the rest of your questions.
All right, before we keep going, quick shout out to Cozy Earth for sponsoring today's show. And I'll be real, this one actually fits perfectly with what we do because we're on here grinding, talking hoops, reacting to games. But when you finally get that downtime, you want to be comfortable. And that's where Cozy Earth comes in. They've got robes and slippers that are built for those quiet moments, like after a long day or just kicking back and watching a game like this. And with Mother's Day coming up, it's actually a really good gift idea because it's not just like a random gift. It's something that she's actually going to use every day. Their robes are super soft. They've got different styles. And the slippers are built to be worn all day, not just around the house for 5 minutes. It's just one of those things that feels premium right away. And the best part, you can try it risk-free. They've got a 100-night trial and a 10-year warranty. So you're not really taking a risk here. So if you're looking for something thoughtful this year for Mother's Day, go to CozyEarth.com and use code HMA for 20% off. And if there's a survey after checkout, just let them know that you came from our show. Because at the end of the day, home starts with mom.
All right. We'll go here. Some positivity. JJ continues to coach his ass off. I'm really confident in him if we ever get a team with two-way talent to coach. I do think we've seen real growth, improvement from JJ Redick on a lot of fronts over the course of the season. I think right now, if you were to ask the Lakers, how do you feel about your decision to make JJ Redick your head coach? Yeah, it's not been perfect. There's things you could point to and say he needs to get better here, here, and here. But in terms of his trajectory, I think the Lakers have got to be pretty pleased with what they're getting from JJ right now.
Yeah, cannot co-sign that more. I think coming off of last postseason, right, there are certainly things that he could have done better that he will admit he should have done better. And I think that Houston series, he was a step or two ahead of Ime Udoka for most of the series. Going into game one, like the Thunder, I think knew that the Lakers were going to throw an aggressive scheme. I felt they weren't fully prepared for how aggressive the scheme was going to be and just seeing some of the turnovers that they had. And so I think they caught them off guard a bit. it's unfortunate they weren't able to score enough to make it a close game down the stretch or a game that they could win. But I think JJ, and I mean, especially on the defensive side, that's the biggest thing for me is give JJ, maybe not the OKC defenders, because I think that's like a once in a generation defensive team, but give him like a top five defense on paper or a top 10 defense on paper and watch how he cooks with that. So I think he's, especially on the defensive side, showed, and then like, you know, baseline out of bounds plays, ATOs, like can draw up a set for a specific situation, he's done a great job there. So yeah, I mean, a lot to be encouraged by with JJ, I think, moving forward.
If JJ had the, let's say not the title team, but the next season, that 2020-2021 team, he would have crushed with that team winning. Because I thought Frank Vogel, his weaknesses were mainly on the offensive end.
Okay. JJ, I remember when they first hired him, my first thought was like, I would just bet on a really smart dude who works really hard and like and loves basketball. And like, it was clear that that was what JJ is. And like, I just am not surprised that he's made so many improvements year over year, and I would expect him to continue to do so.
All right, we'll finish here. When does Austin Reaves get better, though, Jason? The team doesn't need to be better regular season player. He needs to be better in the postseason. At this point, you'd be paying him for regular season play, which is not smart. I would say he's gotten better every year when you look at what he's done. The postseason certainly is a concern. I don't know. How do you respond to this, Jason?
I think that this injury to Luka buys him another year. You know, like I think based on how he performed against OKC, I was kind of worried about him this postseason anyway. Like you were hoping for like a step forward for sure. And unfortunately, we didn't really get a good clean look at that because of his injury. But the way that I look at it is like, yeah, if by next postseason, Luka's healthy and ready to go, and LeBron's healthy and ready to go, and Austin's healthy and ready to go, and they're in a series that they should probably compete and or win in, and Luka plays great, and LeBron plays great, and Austin gives you nothing, then, like, yeah, I think there's a conversation to be had there. But, like, there's a lot of differences between, you know, this season with him coming back from the injury and no Luka, and, like, last year where he was in, like, that third role off of LeBron and Luka. It's just kind of a different role. His usage is lower. Obviously, he didn't play well, but he was more of, like, an off-ball catch-and-shoot guy in that series and just kind of struggled with it. Like, I think next season, if he continued to struggle, I would – at that point, you have him extended, right? So you have him on a deal with potentially 3 to 4 more years on it. And you could have a serious conversation about moving him at that point. But, like, you know, the truth of the matter is you're probably not going to be able to trade him for anybody. You're going to trade him – if you do trade him, you're going to trade him and probably get some lesser basketball players back. So you're kind of in a situation where you have to count on him improving. I just personally think that he's going to improve. And that's just my take on it. And, like, again, like, let's say that he was 100% healthy right now, and Luka was too, and he had a really bad series this year under real expectations with LeBron and Luka carrying their weight, and he wasn't. It'd be a different conversation for me. But he's hurt. Luka's hurt. Like, I just don't see this being like the point where we all suddenly decide Austin's fate. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yes, it does. All right, everybody. Appreciate all of you for joining. If you haven't done so yet, please make sure you do hit the subscribe button. Super chats we didn't get to, I will save. We'll make sure that we do get to those. Guys, obviously a tough game one, but I always enjoy talking through Lakers basketball with you guys.
It's good to see you, dudes. Hopefully next week we got some better news to talk about.
For sure.
So we're going Tuesday? Monday, which would be game...
I think Monday is game four, so we'd go Tuesday.
Monday is game four. Maybe we'll go Tuesday, yeah, after game four.
Yeah, a little obituary. I mean,
are we doing a season wrap-up?
A lot of time between, yeah, not now and then. A lot to react to.
A lot for us to get through. Thank you, everybody.
I think they're going to get one, guys. I think they're going to get one.
Let's get it. Till next time, everybody. See ya. And stay safe.